Thank you. So my name is Darlene Florence. I work for a chemical company called Emery Oleochemicals. Our North American base is out of Cincinnati, Ohio. And since I suspect that very few to none of you are familiar with Emery Oleochemicals, since we've only had an ag platform for about 2 or 3 years now, I'm just going to start with a few details about Emery. Emery's actually been around for 175 years. We'll be 175 next year. We started in Cincinnati with the Procter & Gamble. The Emery family and the Procter & Gamble family were actually very close friends. And so Procter & Gamble went and did the soap and the personal care products, and the Emery company took on the candles and lamp oil. Now that we don't do a whole lot of candles and lamp oil, Emery started looking into fatty acids, oleic acid, and stearic acid in particular, which are used for a wide variety of different feed products and can go into a lot of different applications as well. And then in the 40s, as the war was ending, we started looking into ozone acid technology. So we were able to take that oleic acid and split the double bond, and that gave us azelaic acid and pelargonic acid. Again, azelaic in particular goes into a lot of different products, leather softeners, it will go into acne cream, so it has a wide use. And then in the 1970s, we did a major upgrade to be able to produce glycerin, and it's natural-based. All of our products in Cincinnati come from either tallow or lard, and all of our materials overseas come from peanut oil, or palm kernel oil or coconut oil. And so after the 70s, the family heirs decided that they didn't want to run the company anymore. So it went through about 30 or 40 years of switching between different joint ventures and different like Goldman Sachs sort of companies and venture capitalist sort of thing. So in 2009, Emery came together as a company that is half owned by PTT, which is actually a petrochemical company owned by Thailand. The government of Thailand said you need to expand into these green chemistries. And then the Siam Darby plantation, which is the largest plantation of sustainably grown palm kernel oil in the world, and that's in Malaysia. And so as I mentioned, our Cincinnati plant is here in Ohio, which is in the southeast corner of Ohio. We're just over the river from Kentucky and about a stone's throw from Indiana. Our headquarters are here over in Malaysia at TPG. So that's where all of our headquarters is at, and where we have another manufacturing site. And then our third manufacturing site are in the nearby cities of Lockstedt and Dusseldorf in Germany. And then as you can see from the green, we have some sales sites all over the world. So I just wanted to give you a little background of where we're at. And these boxes here on the left are our six platforms. So AgroGreen is the platform that I work for. But we also have products that go into biolubrication for oil drilling and anytime you have gears and you need a particular type of oil. And then eco-friendly polyols and green polymer additives work with foams and being able to add different things of foams like your seats that you're sitting on. And we're working on a process to be able to recover old foam and recycle it, break it down to its components, and make it into one of the two components that goes into foam. And then our home and personal wellness goes into things like makeup and cream and lotions. They're exclusively right now out of Malaysia. And then our Oleo Basics is our glycerin, our fatty acids, and our fatty alcohols, the products that get sold on the commodity market. So Emery's a large player in a lot of different industries, but we don't sell anything directly to market, so we have things in a lot of different products that you don't see. So we're all here for something agricultural, so I'll switch gears a little bit and talk about the AgroGreen Solutions platform. We have mainly four groups of products. I just wanted to highlight them with time and everything. I won't go through all of them in detail, but we have our Emerine trademark, and that's our green solvents and adjuvants. Those come out of Malaysia, and again, everything's produced from palm kernel oil and coconut oil. Our Emerion products, which I'll talk about a couple of different projects that we worked on today, or I'll talk about those projects today. We've worked on them in the past. will cover work at weed and insect management, and also potentially some fungal management that we're looking at in the future. We have an MTRAL product, which is a plant growth regulator for tobacco, and possibly we're working on one for some abiotic stress, and that's also the Emerlife one, sorry, is the abiotic stress. It's potentially falls under plant growth regulator. We're still looking into that as being fairly new. So as I mentioned with our MRION, we have what we call the 7000 series, which is our herbicide. So it's based on that pelargonic acid, which is that C9 fatty acid. And then we also work with the ammonium soap of that fatty acid. A lot of other soaps of fatty acids are based on potassium. And with some of the work that we've done, the efficacy seems to be a little bit better with the ammonium soaps. It's a non-selective contact mode of action, and what it does is it'll strip the waxy coating from any living tissue. So if you spray it onto the bark, the tree doesn't notice, and it's also biodegradable within about 24 hours. As soon as it hits the soil, because it's a fatty acid, fatty acids are part of living organisms' diets, microorganisms go yay food, and it biodegrades and doesn't provide any environmental damage that way. And then we're also working on an insect repellent, have some products out in the market, the 8000 series, and that's based on a blend of fatty acids, just the straight fatty acids. And the work primarily was done with mosquitoes, but it also repels a number of other flies, horn flies, house flies, and we're continuing to look at what other insects that material repels. And we've also seen that as we start to go down to some of the lower doses, if the insects, especially soft-bodied insects, come into contact with the material, then there's some toxicity there. But if we get some of those higher doses, then it'll repel mosquitoes. And I can say that if, for me personally, I could be in a room with 1,000 people and there would be one mosquito and she would find me, and I've used the stuff and it works. So that alone, and I've been to countries with malaria and crazy mosquitoes and West Nile and all that sort of stuff. So if they're not finding me, this is some good stuff. So I'd like to talk just a brief about a couple of different projects. Since we are a fairly new platform, we have a fairly small group here in Cincinnati and then a fairly small group over in Malaysia. We talk fairly often by email and phone and all of those sorts of things. But one of the projects that we did this year is we looked at using our herbicide on a second year plastic. So plastic culture is often used to reduce weed pressure throughout a season without having to go through and either do tillage or to have to spray throughout the year and not have to worry about getting too close to like a tomato plant or peppers or those different types of vegetables. And so in the second year, they'll often reuse that plastic because the cost of the plastic and the cost of installing it has gotten more expensive. And so we found here, we were a little disappointed, we found that we had some initial control. You can see here, if I can get the mouse, the 4 days after treatment, we had some pretty good control here with our ammoniated soap product, that's what AN stands for, and that when it was 2x applied at 15%, we still had some pretty good control, especially when you compare to the glufosinate and the untreated control. But we found that that just didn't persist into the season as much as we wanted it to. So some of my colleagues had suggested that increasing spray volume might be a way to do that, but with conversations and talks that I've been hearing, increasing spray volume isn't something that growers want to do with the expense of water and the expense of transporting it. So that'll be something that we look at back in the lab and being able to look at with different greenhouse studies of starting to add maybe some packages with some additional adjuvants and surfactants and look at that. So that's something interesting because other work that we've done in the field, we've had success with with weed control. The other piece of a lot of what I do is with collaboration is looking at what our chemistries are and looking at what solutions what problems we can look at in the world and potentially solve. And one of them, maybe not a most popular topic or popular crop to talk about, is tobacco. And currently, the practice is to remove the flowers of tobacco. And what that does is then you increase the photosynthetic products don't go into the flower, they go into the leaf, which increases yield, increases quality. The plant will also then put out a better root system, which if you have a wind or something like that, will keep the plant from lodging. So that's why we go through and look at removal of the flower. Currently, especially in Canada, there's only C10 products, C10 alcohol products that are registered. Here in the States, we have a malic hydrazide product that's registered, that there's an interest in decreasing that product's use because it's systemic and it shows up as residues in the leaves, and there's a lot of buyers who don't want that into their product anymore. So what we did was we started looking at, well, maybe our herbicide, if we can knock it down to a low enough concentration, can give some kill of that tobacco sucker, the flowering piece when it first starts growing, but yet we don't have that phototoxicity. So one advantage of having colleagues on the other side of the world is summer comes way earlier to them than it does to us. And so us, especially in Cincinnati this year, although we didn't have it nearly as bad as anybody up north. And so what we did is they took a 3% ammonium nonanoate and a 5% ammonium nonanoate. And after 30 minutes, you could start to see that there was a little bit of leaf toxicity, a little bit of phytotoxicity. So then, and you can see even after 60 minutes, it gets that much worse for the 3%, and it's even worse for the 5%. So if we look down at a 0.5%, this black part here was a green sucker and it's been burnt, which is what you want. And so we can see, okay, down at 0.5% that you can get some burning of that tobacco sucker. So this is a possibility of a product that might have some use. So what we did was we partnered with universities in the tobacco belt and have looked at it. And I have this in here and I was hoping to have data because they harvest tobacco in August and September, but because spring also came late to North Carolina and Virginia, unfortunately I don't have too much data. I don't have any data to show as far as what happened. From talking with the researcher, he said that there were a couple of plots that looked okay, but there were a number of plots with the ammonium nonanoate that didn't look terribly good. And then the last project I'll talk about is one that's in process right now, and that has to do with honeybee safety. And so the varroa mite, which if you've heard anything about honeybees and colony collapse disorder, you've probably heard about the varroa mite as being a global pest. It moved from Southeast Asia since the 1950s, and it prefers to go after the baby bees, the larva, and will attack and actually live and reproduce in the cells here, and then will live on the adults too, and they're like a tick, and they'll suck the blood, which can weaken the bees. And so the pictures that I have over here of the colony, you can see one here on the mite and the colony, and the mite is known to be a vector for a number of different diseases. The bee that's circled to the left and down, you can see that the wings are deformed. I hope you can kind of see that the wings are deformed, and that's one of the diseases that the mites are looking to carry. So this was kind of an interesting project because the 8,000 series material had been shown in a very small study, kind of quickly done in between some other work that a postdoc was doing in addition to trying to find a job, and you know, postdoc life is very busy. And so what we were able to do, but he was able to show that there was some differences between the toxicity of the mites and the toxicity of the bees for this material. So we were able to utilize polyol researchers in-house that make waxes. This is what they do all day. There are more waxes in my lab than I ever knew that anybody could make in every color completely possible. And so we worked with them to find one that had properties that would be likely to be able to help out in the, be able to work in the beehive. And I'm getting just about ready to grab the can off the stage here. So I do want to show you this. This is preliminary work that just came, I just got last week, that the black line, if I can get the mouse back, the black line is the toxicity to the honeybee, and the red line is the toxicity to the mite. And you can see that the concentration down here, that there's a difference between the two. that you do have to have two lines, you can't do it with one, but that there's some overlap here in the confidence intervals. So the first polyol that we tried had too high of a melting point, so I've just sent them a lower melting point wax, and we're in the process of trying that. So with that, these are my colleagues in the States and overseas that help us with everything, and that's it. Thank you.